There are ways out of the infinite inning, especially if you have somebody on the outside who is willing to anchor you. I've been fortunate enough to have many people like that in my life who do their best to pull me out when I go to that place. The one I live with is particularly dedicated to that, and I have reaped so many unearned rewards from my choice there and from her choices, because I don't think anybody signs up for that, for someone who can be so down that they will self-medicate in a way that can be self-destructive, and what is the past tense of that? Self-destroyed, and yet remain around to pick up the pieces and understand not that you weren't yourself, but that for better or for worse, this is you. Not always, but in the unavoidable sometimes. And while you always mean well, you may not always do well. That is the nature of the thing that vexes your day and haunts your nights. And knows that sometimes all you can do is wait. But the waiting in and of itself is a gesture and a sacrifice and an expression of understanding and dedication. And I don't mean to be melodramatic about the whole thing, but I will say that when I have described what that person has gone through in dealing with me, that otherwise rational and objective people have said, oh yeah, she's a saint, and far be it from me to dispute that. I'm in the state of mind to talk about this because last weekend I attended the wedding of two very dear friends, and such events always put me in mind of marriage and what it means and what you put into it and what you get out of it. And the one thing that I'm certain of, the one essential ingredient, is a deep supply of mutual empathy. Because life is not like your honeymoon. It rolls out one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, just like it did before you were married, just like it did before you ever met. And it has its shares of highs and lows and reversals. And if you don't have someone who is with you at that moment and is willing to call you on it when you're wrong and support you when you're right and hang with you on those sharp turns, then you're in trouble. And I probably shouldn't even say that it's essential, because I've seen many couples in my life who I don't think they have that, and yet they don't get divorced. They go on and on, and it reminds me a bit of the nursery rhyme about Peter Pumpkin Eater. He put his wife in a pumpkin shell. Very often that nursery rhyme is invoked in a feminist context, but I've seen both men and women do that, and not in a sexist way, but just in the way of emotional compartmentalization. Their spouse is someone that they tolerate but don't necessarily relate to, or even spend a whole lot of time with. It's like the Johnny Cash and June Carter song, Jackson, we got married in a fever. Well, the fever passes, and it turns out they haven't got much in common. He's a homebody. She likes going out. She likes baseball. He doesn't. She likes home cooking. He likes takeout. He models his relationship on the often barbed but ultimately affectionate comments that passed between his father and mother, whereas her father and mother barely communicated. She spends her spare time reading. He spends his spare time playing video games. And there's really no overlap in the things that they would want to do together. So what happens when, as in that song, the fire goes out? It's replaced by something deeper, or it's not replaced by anything at all. And again, that doesn't mean you break up. It just means you kind of go on as roommates who theoretically go to bed from time to time. You go on as two armed camps in a permanent state of truce. And we don't have to characterize it all as negative. You can just be good friends who don't necessarily have a lot in common besides the children. I guess that's okay, too. People are happy that way. Or if not happy, contented? Accepting? But that's not my conception of marriage, which is companionate. And there's a whole other category that I just thought of. Couples I've known who reinforce each other. He's paranoid and she's paranoid. And they see the world as a series of plots against them. She's anxious and he's anxious and neither of them can leave the house. There's no right way to do this, and if they go on like that till a natural death do they part, well, who are we to judge? But I think in the end, in the final analysis, when you talk about all these different kinds of couples, you can do without almost everything. Common interests, common tastes, but you can't do without the fervent desire to take care of each other. I will offer as evidence of this assertion, this won't surprise you, Casey Stengel. For those of you who don't know, Casey Stengel is in the Hall of Fame as the manager of the New York Yankees and New York Mets and Boston Braves and Brooklyn Dodgers, but before he went into managing, he was a major league outfielder from 1912 through 1925, and a pretty good one, often a center fielder, and he also spent a good deal of time in right field, a strong hitter for that position, although it's hard to see because it was the dead ball era, and his production was up and down depending on his health. He got hurt a lot. He didn't really have a baseball body. He was short and stocky. His level of engagement did tend to vary, and whether the manager was platooning him or not. He was traded around quite a bit because he liked to mouth off. He got sent away from the Dodgers after returning his contract with a statement saying, "Dear Charles Ebbets, I believe you sent me the groundkeeper's contract by mistake. I am returning it unsigned and await your sending me the real offer." And so he was traded to Pittsburgh, where he didn't get any money either, and so he kind of was sulky, and then he went to the Phillies, who were even further away, both in terms of compensation and involvement in the pennant race. He moved around a lot. He played for every National League team except for the Reds and the Cubs. One sports writer said that he was traded every time two owners got together with a pen. Casey observed that maybe the Reds and the Cubs didn't own any pens. John McGraw, the manager of the Giants, he did apparently own a pen, and in 1921 he took a look at Casey, and even though injuries had kept him from playing for most of that year, he concluded that Stengel had something left at age 30 and traded for him. Stengel literally hopped off the trainer's table and headed for the train station before McGraw could change his mind, and when he first took the field for the Giants, he shouted, "Wake up, Muscles, you're in New York now." He played really well for them, too. The lively ball had come in, McGraw platooned him, and he had just enough still in the way of injuries that he only played about half the time. The lack of exposure actually helped, and in 177 games as a Giant, he hit .349 and slugged .524, which was way better than anything he had done before. Parenthetically, sports writers can be so dumb sometimes. There's a 1961 profile of Casey in the old New York Herald Tribune in which it said, "As a player, Casey Stengel was a pretty good outfielder, but a better comedian. His best home run total for a season was 9, a figure Mickey Mantle has frequently exceeded in a single month." I know it's 50 years too late, but I need to respond to this. How many home runs do you think Mickey Mantle would have hit if his career had started in 1912? It was a dead ball, and they knew that in 1961. Anyway, the Giants were a very good team, and they went to the World Series all 3 years that Casey was there. And in 1923, Stengel was their postseason star, albeit in a losing effort, the first World Series the New York Yankees ever won. They lost in 6 games, but the 2 that they did win were because of home runs by Casey. On October 10th, Game 1 at Yankee Stadium, first World Series game there ever, Casey started in center field for the Giants. The game was tied 4-4 when he came to bat with 2 outs in the top of the 9th against Bullet Joe Bush. Casey was a left-handed hitter, and he smashed a line drive the other way, into the left center field gap where it split the distance between left fielder Bob Musil and center fielder Whitey Witt, and just kept rolling. As Grantland Rice said, it bounded and bubbled all the way to the wall until it stopped there. At that time, the left field power alley was 474 feet, so the ball had quite a way to go. He ran it out kind of strangely. Like I said, he was short and bow-legged, so he wasn't the most natural-looking player to begin with. But there was another problem. One of his injuries that year was incurred at Wrigley Field. They had some kind of hard warning track there, or a warning track precursor, that was just cement. And Casey jumped to make a catch at the wall and came down on his heel, and the bolt that affixed the cleats to the bottom part of his shoe just kind of jammed upward and gave him what we would call a bone bruise that was incredibly painful. And he was trying to stay in the lineup despite that, and ultimately they gave him a kind of orthotic to put in the heel of the shoe. And what happened was, as he was rounding the bases, it all started to fly apart. The orthotic came out, he was losing the shoe, and so it looked like he was hobbling or limping, and the whole effect was kind of comical. And since Casey was a guy who was comical to begin with, it was very natural for people to just look at it and see it as a kind of cartoon. And he was fortunate enough, and we are fortunate enough, that one of the writers who was there was a great writer. His name was Damon Runyon, and he was with the New York American. And this is the description he filed of Casey Stengel's World Series winning inside the park home run. This is the way old Casey Stengel ran yesterday afternoon, running his home run home. This is the way old Casey Stengel ran, running his home run home in a giant victory by a score of 5-4 in the first game of the World Series of 1923. This is the way old Casey Stengel ran, running his home run home when two were out in the ninth inning and the score was tied and the ball was still bounding inside the Yankee yard. This is the way. His mouth wide open, his warped old legs bending beneath him at every stride, his arms flying back and forth like those of a man swimming with a crawl stroke, his flanks heaving, his breath whistling, his head far back. Yankee infielders passed by old Casey Stengel as he was running his home run home. Say, Casey was muttering to himself, adjuring himself to greater speed, as a jockey mutters to his horse in a race, that he was saying, "Go on, Casey, go on." People generally laugh when they see old Casey Stengel run, but they were not laughing when he was running his home run home yesterday afternoon. People, 60,000 of them, men and women, were standing in the Yankee stands and bleachers up there in the Bronx, roaring sympathetically, whether they were for or against the Giants. "Come on, Casey!" The warped old legs, twisted and beat by many a year of baseball campaigns, just barely held out under Casey Stengel until he reached the plate, running his home run home. Then they collapsed. In the aftermath of that World Series, McGraw traded Casey away, even though he liked Casey quite a bit. Casey was a little bitter about this. He said, "I hit two home runs in the World Series and I get traded to Boston. I suppose that if I had hit three home runs, I would have been traded to Terre Haute." More philosophically, he parodied a famous poem by Thomas Gray saying, "The paths of glory lead only to the braves." But that's not really the point of this story. The point of the story is this. Prior to that World Series, Casey had met Edna Lawson, the woman that he wanted to marry, and he had proposed to her fairly early on in their relationship, but she needed some time to think it over, and they went their separate ways for a bit. As Damon Runyon's newspaper report circulated the country, his prospective in-laws saw it and asked Edna, "Who is this elderly gentleman you're thinking about marrying? You sure you want to hitch your wagon to a guy who's at death's door?" And I guess she knew it was hyperbolic, the description, but listener, she married him. You see, this goes back to what I was talking about earlier. I think she wanted to take care of him. One last thought on all this. Damon Runyon was a great writer, not because of that description, but for his short stories, which are still read today. He was known as a chronicler of the unique culture of Broadway, of its touts and gamblers in the early part of the 20th century. His stories are wonderful. They have their own argot. They're always in the first-person present tense, which gives them a really unique voice. Some of his stories, like The Idol of Miss Sarah Brown, became the basis for one of the most successful musicals of all time, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Frank Lesser show Guys and Dolls. But he also wrote about baseball in his fiction, and there's a story that's especially apropos to today's sermon. It's called Baseball Hattie, and it's a little misleading because it initially just seems to be about a woman who's an obsessive Giants fan. "I see many a baseball bug in my time," Runyon's narrator says, "male and female, but without a doubt, the worst bug of them all is Baseball Hattie, and you can say it again. She is most particularly a bug about the Giants, and she never misses a game they play at the Polo Grounds, and in fact, she sometimes bobs up watching them play in other cities, which is always very embarrassing to the Giants, as they fear the customers in those cities may get the wrong impression of New York womanhood after listening to Baseball Hattie a while." Well, it's not really about Baseball Hattie, the baseball fan. It's about Baseball Hattie, the wife. You see, Baseball Hattie gets involved with a young pitcher named Haystack Dugler, who sounds like kind of a combination of Bugs Raymond and Denny McLean, and that's not a positive thing. And I don't want to spoil the whole story for you, but at a moment of crisis, when Dugler is about to do something that in baseball terms is about the most drastic, dire thing that you can do, Hattie decides to save him from his fate by, well, Let's just say that she arranges it so he must have the most severe type of Tommy John surgery possible. I guess you can call that tough love. I guess it's the kind of thing that one might do if they really loved someone and saw them not only heading into the infinite inning, but going somewhere beyond that to a vanishing point where the inning is no longer infinite, but terminal. That's certainly love, even if Runyon played it for comedy. And it's worth remembering that sometimes this is what love is. It's not baking cookies together. It's not going to the theater or even the ball game. It's not even raising the kids together. But being there in the most dedicated way possible. In making a bridge of yourself. Some of us seldom need saving, and some of us need to be saved often. But all of us will need to be saved sometime. And perhaps the most that we can hope for is that the person who knows us best, who has observed us most intimately, having long ago lost all illusions about us, still wants to take us by the hand and lead us down the path, out of the trap, though the forest be dark, though the inning be infinite. Frank Lesser, who wrote Guys and Dolls, was a hard guy, and I don't think he was a sentimentalist, but he had a very beautifully sentimental song that appeared in that show. He'd been holding on to it for a while. He'd originally written it for a movie, and Sam Goldwyn rejected it. And it's probably the most beautiful song in the thing, but it's not in the movie with Frank Sinatra and Marlon Brando, and it's not covered very often, and I think it's because people don't get the words. Lesser describes someone gazing at you with true love as having a sheep's eye and a licorice tooth, both of which are a little bit obscure. Oddly enough, one of the few covers of the song was by Paul McCartney a few years ago, and he changed those words because I suspect he didn't get them either. But what Lesser was looking for was a more poetic way of saying a sheepish eye, a shy eye, and a lustful look, or a libidinous look, or a lecherous look. But those words sound like they have a negative connotation, and in searching for other words that would convey the same sentiment in a more benevolent-sounding way, he came across this phrase with an archaic spelling, licorice tooth. Sounds like the candy, licorice. But it means the same thing. It suggests physical longing. The song is called More I Cannot Wish You, and I'd like to play that song for my newly married friends now. But rather than play McCartney's altered version, I'm going to use the version that, oddly enough, was recently sung by the actors John Barrowman, Victor Garber, and Jesse L. Martin on an episode of The Flash television show.
Velvet, I can wish you for the color of your coat and fortune smiling all along your way. But more I cannot wish you than to wish you find your love, your own true love this day.
Mansions I can wish you, 7 footmen all in red, and calling cards upon a silver tray. But more I cannot wish you than to wish you find your love, your own true love this day. Standing there, staring at you, full of the bloom of youth. Standing there, gazing at you, with a sheep's eye and a licorice tooth.
Music I can wish you, merry music while you're young, and wisdom when your hair has turned to gray. But more I cannot wish you than to wish you find your love, your own true love this day.
With a sheep's eye and a licorice tooth,
and the strong arms to carry you away,
and the strong arms to carry you
pretty, isn't it? They changed one of Lesser's words, too. The last line of the song is normally, "The strong arms to carry you home." But I think it'll do. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Stand at the bridge at Antietam Creek and you say, "General, I don't care if you shoot me for cowardice in the face of the enemy. I am not going across that bridge. They have got the whole thing sighted." And the general says, "But son, victory is across that bridge. Freedom is across that bridge. Episode 26 is across that bridge." And that sure as hell doesn't convince you, so you refuse to go. They line up a firing squad and you're shot. Should have joined the Navy. Welcome back to the show. I'm so very pleased to be talking to you again. Today I'm joined by Craig Calcaterra of Hardball Talk, and we had a great conversation, but I have to confess that this one was one of the harder productions that I've gone through. Look, I joke about our producer, it's me, and I am not a natural at this. That is the joke. Sometimes when you're podcasting, weird things happen, strange things, things you can't account for except by recourse to the supernatural. And I will give you an example. I don't normally play outtakes, but I'm just going to quickly share one or two with you. About halfway through recording this episode, sound was dicey the whole time, but I had to interrupt Craig. I said, "Are you hearing all that distortion?" And he said, No, I don't hear anything. I said, "Oh, okay, good, good." And I thought, well, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just imagining it, or maybe it's all on my end. I can't worry about that. On with the show. But when I went to put the package you are now listening to together, I played back his track and isolated that distortion, and this is what I heard. Yes, brothers and sisters, the ghosts of the damned are haunting Craig Calcaterra's microphone. That, whatever it was underscoring every single word he said for the course of an hour, and it proved to be very, very difficult to remove because the damned want to be heard. That's why they're damned. It's also why you can find them in such great numbers on Twitter. I got rid of most of it in the end, but you will hear it pop out occasionally along with other strange artifacts, and I'm sorry. I'm just completely flummoxed by this whole podcasting thing, and I'm going to keep up with it, but I there's some things I can't explain. And one other thing, which is normally if you listen back to the entire run of this show to date, you will note that the guest is usually the last voice you hear when I'm saying goodbye. I give them the last word. I thank them for stopping by, and then they say whatever they want to say, and we go to the reprise of The Infinite Man before I usher us out. But I couldn't do that today because as the show went on, the damned became more and more assertive, and I think they took Craig over completely. As the show ends, you will hear me make a joke about eating bad shrimp. Craig laughed at that. But my friends, it wasn't Craig. I know Craig. I like Craig a great deal. Craig is a very nice man. This was no longer Craig speaking. So listen, I'm a little frightened, and once I turn this episode in, I'm moving, and our next broadcast will be conducted from a secret location where the damned cannot find me. Our first segment ran a lot longer than usual, so I'm going to turn it over to Craig directly rather than give you the 10 or 15 minute story that I typically put in this spot. I do briefly want to get into one thing from the postseason because I can't get this out of my mind. With all of the ways that we've been first guessing and second guessing managers, and social media is so good for that now, that whether you like or dislike some of these coaches, whether you think they're really good at their jobs or really bad, they're under immense pressure. Pressure to the degree that Joe Maddon even commented on it after one of the games of the recently concluded NLCS. Sorry, Joe. In one sense, that's new, and in another sense, it's not. But between the Joe Girardi thing of not having a play reviewed and some of his different pitching changes in terms of Maddon leaving Wade Davis in the pen to lose a game with John Lackey, there are some really strange moves and non-moves being made. And as always, I try to think about antecedents for that. And the one that keeps coming to mind is one you may be familiar with because it's kind of a legendary World Series story. It's from Game 4 of the 1941 World Series between the Yankees and the Dodgers. Again, I don't think we have time to get into the whole thing at the usual length, but just very briefly, the Brooklyn Dodgers were home against the Yankees. They took a 4-3 lead to the top of the ninth inning. They got two outs. They had nobody on. The pitcher in the game for them was Hugh Casey, who was kind of their fireman, not really a closer. He'd been in since the fifth inning. That's the way they did it back then. He was kind of a portly Georgian. He drank a bit, and that gave him kind of a beer belly. He threw sinkers and off-speed stuff, breaking balls. He had a big breaking ball and a small breaking ball, which is important to this story. Leo Durocher, who was one of those managers who for a while was a little ahead of the curve on developing relief pitchers, used him both as a swing man and as a fireman. So he would throw, say, 150 innings a year, split between the rotation and the bullpen, sometimes more of one or the other, sometimes less. So he was on the mound. The catcher was Mickey Owen, a defensive specialist. That's important, too. And the batter was the great Yankee outfielder first baseman Tommy Henrich, a power hitter. He worked the count to 3-2, and then Casey threw something, and what that something is remains controversial to this very day. Some people, including Casey, oddly enough, said later that it was a spitter. Henrich said it was not. Owen said that it was not. Leo Durocher, the manager of the Dodgers, said that Casey didn't even have a spitter, and since he threw a sinker, and a spitter mimics the movement of a sinker, why the heck would he need two of the same pitch? Henrich sees what he describes as a big breaking ball, misses it by a foot, strikes out. But he thinks to himself, if I had such trouble with that, maybe Owen did too. And indeed, the ball had gotten by Owen and rolled all the way to the backstop. He didn't move after it that fast, or he didn't shift his feet right. It was the kind of thing that Gary Sanchez gets criticism for, even though Owen was highly regarded as a defensive catcher. And because it was the end of the season, and you can see this in the photographs of the moment, I guess they didn't work as hard at keeping the field in pristine shape as they do now, so there was all this clumpy grass behind home plate, a lot of dirt. They had not resodded the field as it had gotten worn down by 77 games of play, and there was nothing to stop the ball. Henrich reached. Now, Durocher did come out on the field at that point because the police, thinking that the game was over and they had to do crowd control, had also jumped on the field, and Durocher was worried that they had interfered with Owen's field of vision, causing the wild pitch or pass ball or whatever you want to call it. It was ruled a pass ball. Sports writer Tom Meaney was thinking of Durocher's reputation when he said that it was the only time he could recall seeing a criminal chase the police. But that was all Durocher did. He went back to the dugout, and the inning got very strange from there. Henrich's on first. Joe DiMaggio comes up next and rips the first pitch he sees to left field for a single. First and second. Charlie Keller comes up. He doubles all the way to the right field wall, scoring two runs. Casey then walks Bill Dickey, brings up Joe Gordon, and he doubles, scoring two more runs. It's now 7-4 Yankees. Casey wasn't done. He then walked Phil Rizzuto, which brought up pitcher Johnny Murphy. The Yankees didn't pinch hit because they want Johnny Murphy to close it out, and he grounds out to end the inning. And at no time did anyone go out to the mound, think about making a pitching change. I believe the Dodgers' bullpen was empty. And in Durocher's autobiography, which is a very good book in which he excuses himself for quite a few sins, as you would expect somebody to do in their autobiography, he questions himself on this. He said, "I'm not strapped to the bench. Why didn't I go out?" And he had just frozen. This was one of the more street-smart managers, and yet he just couldn't get himself out of the dugout. He watched a World Series game collapse. He watched one of his pitchers just fall apart on the mound, and it was the second time in that series for Casey, by the way, and he did nothing. And for that matter, the catcher did nothing. Everybody just stood by helplessly. 9 batters came to the plate. The Dodgers took no action. That put the Yankees up 3-1, and in the clubhouse after the game, DiMaggio told his teammates, "They're not coming back from that." And indeed, they didn't. The next day, they lost Game 6 and thereby the series, and almost all of the principals involved, DeRocher, Henrik, Owen, spent a good deal of time over the rest of their lives reliving that moment, even though they all had other equally fascinating things and more successful things happen to them. The one exception to that was Hugh Casey. Not quite 10 years later, he checked into a hotel room and committed suicide. Was there a cause and effect? I don't know. I sort of doubt it. Maybe it was one item on his list. We can never know, and maybe I don't want to know, because I don't want the consequences of baseball to be that serious. And yet, he's not the only player who has had that kind of negative spotlight moment who has chosen to take that way out. DeRocher brings it up in his autobiography, and I think it's his way of disclaiming responsibility for any of it, which does indeed make him the weasel that people said he was. But I think the bigger takeaway is this. One of my favorite baseball stories that I've been involved in personally is that back in the 90s, the Yankees had Chuck Knobloch, and Knobloch developed the yips at second base and couldn't throw. He eventually had to be moved to the outfield. And Willie Randolph was a coach at that time, and Willie Randolph was one of the best and steadiest second basemen that I've ever seen. And I went to the Yankees clubhouse, and I asked Knobloch, "Have you sought Willie's advice?" And Knobloch looked up at me and he said, No, I haven't. You would think that would be obvious, wouldn't you? Sometimes you don't do the obvious thing, even though it is obvious. It was a very strange conversation, but that phrase, "that would seem obvious, wouldn't it," has stayed with me all these years for situations when one fails to take some action which is the easiest and most linear action that they could have taken. And in Game 4 of the 1941 World Series, that game where the Dodgers watched a 4-3 lead turn into a 7-4 loss, nobody did the thing that was most obvious. Nobody on the field, nobody in the dugout, just went to Hugh Casey and said, "Hey, slow down." So when a manager now forgets to make a replay or subscribes to some harebrained scheme about preserving his closer for a lead that he might never get, I sort of understand it. It's not that they're dumb, it's that they're dumb in that moment, because nothing can lower your IQ like stress. I'm not saying that excuses it, because these guys are paid to perform under difficult conditions, and I think it's fair that we expect that, but they're still human. It's been 76 years since that game, and nothing about that has changed. I'll be back with Craig Calcaterra in just a moment. When Gilbert and Sullivan wrote the song "When I, Good Friends, Was Called to the Bar," W.S. Gilbert wrote, "All thieves who could my fees afford relied on my orations, and many a burglar I've restored to his friends and his relations." Faced with a similar dilemma, my next guest turned to baseball. He's the master of NBC's Hardball Talk. He's Craig Calcaterra. How are you, Craig?
I'm great, and that's exactly how I thought of it at the time, too.
Complete in verse? There were rhymes in the dialogue?
It was uncanny, yes.
Before we get to the postseason, which I'm sure you're enjoying greatly, as we all are, last night an article by Tracy Ringlesby came out of Baseball America talking about the possibility that we will have expansion to Portland and a return to Montreal, a reduction of the schedule from 162 to 156 games, expanded playoffs, and I was wondering what your thoughts were.
I haven't had a ton of time to process it. I saw the report, and I haven't done the deep dive into the reaction to the report, which is always where the more interesting stuff comes from. I have been skeptical of a Portland expansion for some time, for a lot of Portland-specific reasons. Now, maybe those things have changed as far as the business community or what's available stadium-wise or any of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I'll believe Portland when they actually break ground on a stadium. Montreal seems like they've been eager to get an expansion team for some time. It wouldn't shock me at all if they were able to make that happen. As far as expansion in general, I'm for it. I think it's fine. I know there's always some hand-wringing when there's talk of expansion about talent dilution and things like that. But when you track, you know, population growth versus population of baseball player growth and all that kind of stuff, I think there's plenty of room for a couple of more teams. It would make scheduling easier. I really don't see a downside to expansion in and of itself. As far as reducing the length of the regular season and expanding the playoffs, I think it's most important. People are going to want to talk about this in terms of what it means for baseball, what it means for records, what it means for purity. I don't care so much about that because we've had a lot of flux in baseball over time. It has to be fully understood only in terms of money. That's what's going on with this. Expansion fees put hundreds of millions of dollars into Major League Baseball owners' coffers. Reducing the size of the regular season is only possible if there is a makeup on the revenue somewhere else, which would come from expanded playoffs and those franchise fees. So it can only be understood as a financial move. And when we get to those normal end of the season topics and winter topics that Ken Rosenthal and people like to talk about of, maybe we should reduce the size of the season, maybe we should expand the playoffs, those almost always go nowhere. This as a whole kind of makes a lot more sense to me as a real thing, when they talk about it in a way that would make up for the revenue loss from the length of the season and stuff like that. That makes me think that people are seriously thinking about it.
Baseball has always said, this goes back to Bud Selig and Rob Manfred, they are not going to consider expansion until they resolved certain issues. One, it was the stadium issue in Oakland, which does seem to be finally having at least some movement, although there's no commitment to breaking ground anywhere. They do seem to be driving a little harder on that. It seems like they're going to stay instead of move to some other part of the Bay Area. I don't know if this has the same priority for baseball, but the two Florida teams are problematic. The Rays, their stadium, they need a new ballpark. They haven't been able to get anywhere with that. And although they were just sold, the Marlins, the new ownership with Derek Jeter, is determined to reduce payroll to a point that really doesn't seem to make them a viable team. And I don't think baseball wants to abandon the Florida market, but they're also not successful there. I wonder if they can responsibly expand to 32 teams in a way that may have the effect of taking two extant teams, those two Florida teams, and bumping them further down the charts in terms of revenue and kind of permanently consigning them to bastard stepchildren status.
Yeah, that is a concern, especially with Tampa Bay. I mean, they do have an issue. Now, they had some minor movement on their stadium as far as I think they're out of the world where they're no longer even allowed to negotiate or look for possible stadium sites out of St. Petersburg. I think that was a huge problem that did get resolved. So the owners of the Rays now can at least think about moving to Tampa at some point, even though they're still locked in their stadium for a long time and there's no clear new stadium on the horizon at all. So that's definitely a big problem. Miami, I don't know what you do there. I mean, you got a brand new ballpark, basically. I mean, not brand new, but a perfectly fine newer ballpark there. You know, you do have new ownership. I think the Tampa Bay market is probably more viable than when you look at things like TV ratings and stuff like that. I think the Tampa Bay market is more viable than the Miami market, which just doesn't seem all that interested. It'll be interesting to see, though, if the Marlins, you know, we have a new owner, everybody hates Loria. You get new ownership, and as you said, they're probably going to cut things to the bone for a long time. If they can do it in a way that in 4 years they're competitive and interesting, let's give Miami a chance to actually become a baseball market with a nice stadium and ownership that everybody doesn't hate. But that's a big if. Who knows? I mean, maybe they're just going to wallow forever. So yeah, that's a huge problem. But I think the Oakland thing might have really sealed it. As I'm sure you know, and a lot of people who follow relocation and stadium sort of topics in baseball, Major League Baseball has always loved to have like the bogey city out there, the negotiation ploy city that they could use against other cities to get new stadiums and concessions and things like that. If they are seriously thinking about Portland or Montreal or somewhere else, it probably suggests that baseball anyway is confident that they're done with that, that something's going to happen in Tampa Bay, something's going to happen in Oakland, and now the new way to get money is new teams.
The Marlins plan seems really dangerous in the sense that, yes, are seeing right now the results of what happened to the Houston Astros back around what, 2010, 2011, where they lost 100 games 2-3 years in a row. They reaped a whole bunch of high draft picks. They hit on those high draft picks to a high level, getting guys like Carlos Correa. But first of all, there's no guarantee that you will do that. We've seen teams like the Royals finish at the bottom of the standings year after year after year, and it took them forever, if you want to count between World Series titles, roughly 30 years to rebuild properly, competently, completely. There's certainly no guarantee, even if you pick the right guys, that their arms don't fall off, that they don't randomly fail to develop for whatever reason, or that you make the correct veteran for prospect swaps and it all coheres into a team. And then the other problem is that the arbitration system and the free agency system tends to punish teams in that you only have a 3 to 6 year cycle before your payroll is going to start elevating again. So you're under massive pressure to tear it all down, rebuild it, and then scrap it all over again, assuming that the nature of the market doesn't change. And I just don't see how, given the financial levels that they're talking about, that you can ever succeed consistently or on any kind of rational basis.
No, it doesn't make that much sense to me. And I think the whole idea of the major teardown like Houston did, I mean, that's dicey in baseball under the absolute best conditions. Everything hit absolutely right for the Astros to even be able to do that. And when I say absolutely right, that means including, you know, an 111 loss season. There was a very smart brain trust that went down there that took over. They hit on great draft picks, not just getting them, but they actually hit on the draft picks. And then the one they missed on, Aiken, that pitcher, they got a compensation pick that hit too and turned into Bregman. I mean, everything went absolutely right to turn that into a good rebuild. I don't think that that's replicable in baseball. Certainly nothing you can bank on the way it might be in basketball. And for a team to say, we're going to do this now, when your baseball executive has absolutely no experience. Derek Jeter is a wonderful man, but he has not built anything bigger than a crib for his new kid.
Right, a mansion and a yacht, to quote Elmer J. Fudd.
Exactly. So there's no reason to believe that he can do it. I mean, maybe he'll be great, but there's no track record for him. And given the way that these team purchases have been financed in the last few years, I mean, the debt loads are incredible that these guys take on to run these teams, and the debt service is incredible. And the idea that you're going to have this never-ending fountain of cash coming in that people will leave for a couple of years because of TV rights deals and things like that, well, that's not going to last forever. It's already starting to diminish, and it's never going to be as big in Miami as it was in, say, Los Angeles or something. I don't think there's any guarantee at all that the Marlins will first get good, and then, as you said, even if they do get good, that they're going to get the sort of revenue bumps out of a successful young team that will allow them to sustain that past that short window. I mean, you're going to see what we saw with the Rays. The Rays were really good for a few years, and they're still competitive. But you know, the team that came up in 2008 was not able to be held together for a long time, and you're going to see these patterns happen with young, undercapitalized teams. So the product that you get, it's funny, you mentioned a second ago that you're going to have this sort of haves and have-nots kind of league. I don't know that if you asked Rob Manfred and a bunch of owners and they were completely honest and knew that it would never get out, they would be unhappy with that idea. just from a business perspective, right? I mean, you'll have some franchises that might not ever be able to compete on the same financial footing as a whole bunch of them, but you got the Premier League and you've got these big alpha dog teams in the Premier League. I think they look to models like that, even though it's radically different, of course. I think they look to models like that and are like, you know what, the competitive balance is nice, but it's not essential, especially if you expand the playoffs and you give the argument of greater competitive balance than you truly have. I don't think that the real issue is competitive balance. I think it's entertainment balance. And for as much as we want to diminish the regular season and make it all about who's winning the championships, baseball for 6 months it's an entertainment choice for fans. And I just don't know how entertaining it would be to go see the Miami Marlins from 2018 through 2022 if Derek Jeter does what he says he's going to do.
Steve here, interrupting his own show to say that we'll be right back after these messages from our sponsor, but you might not actually hear any ads. It's consistent with the theme of the show. There are other aspects of that. I mean, they may feel that way, and they may like having a couple of patsies on the schedule, but they also look at revenue sharing payments, And they get grumpy when they have to subsidize teams that aren't really trying. And we've seen that with them phasing out the subsidies to Oakland right now. We've seen owners complain about teams like the Marlins not putting the full amount of money back in towards their team and whether they're just pocketing those payments. We also have to realize that even though maybe it's not as big a part of baseball finances as it used to be, that teams do get a part of, say, the road gate. And if nobody comes to a ballpark, they make less money on those road trips. And of course, having a lame team on your schedule incoming to your ballpark affects things that way too. So maybe a certain amount of unevenness is good for the overall story of the season, but to have a 62 Mets just parked there regularly is not beneficial.
I would agree with that. I think that most of that conversation is stuff that happens with the collective bargaining agreement. That's when, you know, the stuff gets baked about revenue sharing and how that all works. And part of me wondered, I'm a horrible cynic about the Major League Baseball Players Association these days. They've done a terrible job the last few negotiations. But what people have never, not what a lot of people don't see anyway, what the average fan doesn't see in the labor stuff in baseball is it's always, it's not just players versus owners, it's owners versus other owners. And a lot of what happened in the 90s and into the early 2000s when there was a lot of labor acrimony, it was more about high-revenue teams being mad at low-revenue teams and their battles sort of playing out into the union negotiation as well. The union, in some ways, I won't say has been vanquished. I think that's putting it too far. But I think Major League Baseball owners are far more comfortable now taking their disputes with the other owners and putting it higher in priority. And I wonder if in the next round or something like that, they're going to have some sort of solution for the problem you described. But, you know, or maybe not a solution, but, you know, appeasement of some kind. But yeah, it's a complicated stew. But I also think that owners have always been somewhat short-sighted. And if someone's saying, well, you know, we're going to split a $400 million or a $500 million franchise expansion fee or something, or however much that's going to be, that's going to be very hard for them to resist.
This is maybe a slight risk, but I do worry about, as you said, Tony Clark being a little bit accommodationist. And I was thinking about this in context of what's happening in the NFL, which is not something you and I got to talk about the last time that you were on because it was June and the NFL season hadn't happened yet. But it seems to me that if baseball's owners, say, 40 years ago had tried to say, you either kneel for the national anthem or you don't play, that Marvin Miller would have led a walkout. Whereas you can't trust the NFL Players Union to have a similar level of solidarity. And I don't know if in a similar situation, how the Baseball Players Association would react.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think this particular example, like we're seeing in the NFL, is probably not very applicable to baseball just because of the sort of political and social orientation of most baseball players. No matter what your solidarity level is, I imagine that most baseball players would say, yeah, we're totally fine with the anthem thing. But let's, you know, just put in a different sort of quality of life or work rules environment. I think a huge portion of the priority for baseball players now in the labor context, it's all shifted from the pocketbook issues to sort of quality of life issues. They talk a lot more now about, you know, days off and what kind of hotels we can stay in. And I don't mean that in the sense of it's all just about luxury based. I mean, these are real issues for these guys. But there, I think you would see more solidarity. If all of a sudden there was a rule that says you got to report to the clubhouse at 7 a.m. for day games or something, you know, or just whatever, I think there'd be huge solidarity and stuff like that. I think if it was outward looking and political or social or dealt with, you know, old time fundamental labor issues, I think you wouldn't see it very much. But the union hasn't been tested in a long time. The owners have been very wise since 2002, I think, when was the last really bad blow up right before they averted a strike right before the New Deal, in not being incrementalist so much, but just not trying to, with one fell swoop, get what they want. They've pushed the union, and every single time they've pushed the union has caved. And on no single issue that the owners have pushed on could the union point to it and say, this is a life or death line in the sand issue for us. But in the aggregate, they've lost all kinds of ground. And I think the owners will continue to do that. I think they're pretty smart about not trying to force the union to either show solidarity or die. Because push comes to shove, they probably will. but they've been doing a good job eroding their position in the last few cycles.
Well, the revenue pool has gotten so big that they can give ground on the overall pool, and if their percentage of the pool is smaller, they're still making for what for most of us would be crazy amounts of money. But I think the crisis will come, and I really hope it never comes, but if it comes, I think it will be at a point that you pointed out a few minutes ago, which is that as people unplug from cable and as these regional sports network payments erode a little bit from the levels that they were at, or erode a lot for that matter, then you're going to see baseball revenues contract a little bit and the owners might dig in a little bit harder. And at that point, you might have more of a scrap. And I'm not saying it will be the next collective bargaining agreement, but one or two down the line.
Oh, yeah. And even if it doesn't get to the point where it's severely impacting teams' viability, I mean, they're getting a lot of more money these days. Owners are getting a lot of money that the players don't even see from the digital side, from the BAM deal, from Disney and all that kind of stuff. The owners could maybe be okay on that end, but see TV revenue. I mean, the owners are diversifying their revenue, right? But they're diversifying it in a way that is not nearing to the players. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with that. I am convinced that the TV revenue stuff is going to be a huge, huge problem for baseball. I can't point to any of the big rights deals that have been signed in the last 5 or 6 years or so. There have been some huge ones that when they expire, someone will say, yeah, let's do that again. I don't know who's going to give... What did Fox give them for the national stuff? Like $3 billion or something? I don't know anyone that's going to give Major League Baseball a couple of billion dollars for a national deal. And on some of these local deals, it does make maybe a little bit more sense. But like the ones like the Dodgers got that was over $1 billion, that I just can't see that. And when that doesn't happen, things are going to change. It's going to be very, very strange.
The BAM side of it is really interesting, actually, in that they built this massive technology company that's been ridiculously successful. And as you said, it's diversified into using the applications that they developed to promote baseball and market baseball over the internet. And they are selling them to other sports, other media entities, so they can take advantage of that expertise. And it's baseball adjacent, and it wouldn't have happened without baseball, but that's revenue that you can't necessarily say the players have a claim to exactly.
Well, I think the ship sailed. I think they blew it. They had a claim to it at its infancy, and that would have been not this past collective bargaining agreement, but like the one before, and maybe even the one before that. You know, you've got this grand business idea. We are proof of concept. And like you said, it would not have become the business it did if they didn't show how successful it was for baseball. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if the Disney-controlled BAM now is making a crap ton of money, I don't even know what they do. They have Showtime. Who knows what they have? But, you know, with some, you know, movie streaming service or, you know, every Pixar movie is now available to every preschooler's house. You know, that's not revenue that Andre Ethier can come in and say, hey, I'm entitled to some of that. So I think they blew it. I think it's just like anything else, any other business. If you're not an early investor, you're not in on the ground floor, you're kind of screwed. And the players, I think, really blew that one.
So let's turn a little bit to the playoffs that are ongoing. As we are talking here on Tuesday morning, the Dodgers are up over the Cubs 2-0 in the NLCS, and the Astros lead the Yankees 2-1 in the ALCS. Last night, I really enjoyed the game to a point, not necessarily the fact that it turned into a blowout. I'm talking about Yankees-Astros, but that it was great to see CeCe Sabathia just pouring those 80-mile-an-hour sliders into the opposite batter's box and have them break over the plate. And as someone who I think is at least as much of a geek as I am, I kept thinking of Star Trek VI and... George Takei saying, it was a pleasure to see you in action one last time, Captain Kirk. It's just a lot of fun to see a veteran who's no longer a fireballer recover himself, especially Sabathia, who's been through so much with the alcohol problems and various injuries. And just the fact that there haven't been a lot of 6'6", 300-pound pitchers in baseball, in fact, none. So every time that Sabathia takes the mound, he kind of sets a new precedent as far as endurance for this kind of Cadillac-framed pitcher.
I am enjoying the, I don't know if it's the third act or the fourth act, I'll call it the third act of CeCe Sabathia's career. this, not monster bounce back, but modest bounce back of the 2017 season was good to see. He was a reliable starter again, which was really nice. He started a lot. He was good in Yankees games. He was good in Yankees games after losses, if you believe in the stopper theory of starters. And it's just enjoyable to see. And as an old guy, I like to see older guys doing well. Yesterday, before the game, you go on Facebook and you see your little On This Day thing, the little Facebook flashback thing or whatever. It was 8 years to the day that Sabathia had started game one of the ALCS against the Angels. I don't know the context of me watching it. I don't even remember watching it. But my status on Facebook that day was, I don't give a crap about the Yankees, but it's really great to see CC Sabathia pitch well. And 8 years later, the exact same sentiment when I woke up yesterday morning and when I went to bed last night. I love to see him pitch well. And it's an added bonus now. I don't know if it's contrarian or people like variety, but in an age where every single pitcher throws 97 miles per hour practically, it is great to see someone who pitches a little bit differently. And it's not a nostalgic thing, because back when Tom Glavin was playing his trade, I wanted to see a new Nolan Ryan. You know, I just want something different. I want variety. And now that everyone is Nolan Ryan, it's good to see someone crafty again, if we could use that word, with a guy who, like you said, is as big as Sabathia is. A little bit with Rich Hill, I felt the same way with the Dodgers in Game 2 as well. It's just, he's an older guy. He obviously has some freakishly good stuff. So it's not like he's, you know, out there trying to get by on guile alone. He's an immensely talented pitcher, especially of late. But seeing someone successful with a little less velocity, someone who works a little quicker, it's just a lot more pleasing for me, because I'm definitely in the camp of amping up for max effort on every single pitch, and then taking 30, 40 seconds between every single pitch is just killing me this postseason.
Yes. Jamie Moyer came up, I think, when I think had just finished ninth grade. And for years, I would say, as long as Moyer is still pitching, I'm still young. And now that ship has sailed, and I'm definitely older than CC Sabathia, and yet I still take some pleasure in the thought that whatever he is, 38, it's not that old. You can still go out there and do something. They don't need to take you out behind the barn and put you down at that point.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's good and it's bad to see someone like CC Sabathia. Just from my own selfish point of view, you get that whole deal where you start to count the number of players left who are older than you, and they start to disappear. And Bartolo Colon is the last one in baseball who's older than me, and it's only by a couple of months. You see that happen, and you start to get a little depressed. So when you see an older guy do well, that's good. Now, Sabathia is younger than me, but now it's becoming a problem in that I was a fully formed adult, married with an adult job, and not too far away from being a father when Sabathia debuted in 2001. And when you see the entire arc as a, you know, grown-ass man of a baseball player, that starts to be weird, because this is just now starting to happen to me. I mean, until the last couple of years, guys who were retiring were guys who I was still, like, in college or whatever when they, you know, when A-Rod started, I was still in college. I wasn't married yet, stuff like that. But, you know, Sabathia, 2001, man, I was 28 years old then. So it's starting to be a little bit weird when these old timers, quote unquote, are younger than you, and you remember them when they were significantly younger than you.
This is a little morbid, but I mean, when Don Baylor passed away, I had to reflect on that a little bit, because Don Baylor was a guy I used to see play regularly and was such a part of the texture of baseball during his career, because he was looked at as a leader and he was kind of passed from contender to contender at the end of his career. And then he went on to manage, which was maybe a little bit less successful. It turns out that maybe being a clubhouse leader is being different than being an on-field leader for an entire team. But when players face mortality at an early age, and when they are players that you grew up watching, it really is kind of a cold shower about the overall arc of our existence.
Yeah, and it's going to be even worse when somebody like that passes, and you can't really say it was at an early age. You know, it's going to be when Greg Maddux goes and he's like, you know, 87 or something like that, and I still am a human in denial of how old I am. I'm going to be, oh, that was so sad. Oh, wait, he's 87. Okay, you know, that's going to be a little different. The one thing that I do kind of like about this whole aging thing is, one of it, as you know, having talked to me for years and stuff, one of my least favorite things is, you know, back in my dayism and players saying that, you know, no one does it like we did when we were young. There is something deliciously hilarious about seeing a guy who plied his trade in the 1990s, or, you know, soon it'll be guys in the 2000s talking about how the game was played differently back when I was a player, and today they just don't do it the right way and stuff. I'm like, no, this was, man, that was the 90s. Forget it. You were wearing the Futures jerseys and, you know, amped up on every PED possible. The back in my dayism is completely resilient to any fact or any change. And when I see guys who are my age or younger doing it, that's the evidence. That's the tell.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, if a player comes out and says, back in my day, we were leaping tall buildings in a single bound, it's because they all had entire Walgreens in them. And I'm not a huge
believer. We will see it.
Right.
We will see it. We are going to, I don't know who it'll be, but there'll be some guy who played on the late 1990s Texas Rangers who will be a commentator, and maybe not even a guy who did PEDs himself, maybe like a young guy who came, you know, Ian Kinsler or Michael Young or somebody will be a studio guy, and they'll be talking about how a playoff game ended 2-1, and they're going to be talking about how sad it is that there's no power in the game anymore, and there's just something wrong with these kids, and it's going to be hilarious.
That must be an uncomfortable position to be in, and you know, I'm a bit of an agnostic when it comes to the PED stuff, because I just don't think that the effect has been demonstrated to the same degree that say this year people like Ben Lindbergh and other writers have shown, and I mean you can see it with your eyes, you don't necessarily need the advanced study, that the ball is just a wee bit juiced, shall we say. It's going to be very awkward to be the pot calling the kettle black in that situation when, as you said, say you were, if not a participant in that culture, at least implicated in it just by being present for it. And then how can you criticize anybody? If the Red Sox get offended by Dennis Eckersley nitpicking how some pitcher pitches, at least Dennis Eckersley was out there on the mound throwing no-hitters and winning 20 games and stuff like that. You can't really be Juan Gonzalez and then talking about how guys aren't hitting 45 home runs often enough.
That won't stop them. I mean, it won't stop them at all. There's a huge cognitive dissonance there. The point you made a second ago about you can't really point to the PEDs or something in the evidence. And this is the way I would like to see a player of that era handle it later if they start to be more forthcoming about it and everything. Every single event of significance, be it in sports or be it in life or anything, it has multiple causes and multiple factors that lets it happen. PEDs did not cause the offensive explosion. They contributed, but so did ballparks, and so did strike zones, and so did equipment, and so did everything else. There's nothing that has a single thing that you could really point to that is at all complicated. And that's the one thing I hate the most about sports. I think we are reductive in life, in politics, and in policy, and in everything, in science. People tend to be reductive and trying to find a single cause for something. I think we're way worse about it in sports than we are elsewhere because we still consider sports to be just kind of a toy box for people. But I hate that. We'll always have that. I don't know if we'll ever have the Fox commentator, former player, who will talk about that, because that's not good TV, but oh well.
I was kind of expecting you to segue into a critique of the Warren Report at that moment.
We could go that way. We could probably go that way.
They're about to dump the last papers from that, and it's a question of whether the administration will sign off on it, and who knows what this administration will sign off on or not, in both good and bad directions. And it will be very interesting to see what comes out of that, because the remaining papers relate to the fact that before the assassination, Oswald went down to Mexico City and talked to a lot of Cuban and Russian spies, which is the one aspect of the whole thing that can still, even if you are not a conspiracy guy, make you just a little bit uncomfortable.
Oh, I can imagine you don't want to upset Russia if you're Trump, right? So, you know, you don't want to do that. and then who knows? You know Roy Cohn's name is somewhere in those files. And he was Trump's big mentor. I think that this is the biggest problem that we have on a big macro level is we have too many old people running things now who've been around too long. Anyone over the age of 70 still is like very emotionally invested or actually was historically invested in a bunch of crazy 1960s, 1970s culture war, Cold War crap. We just need to kind of have all these people move aside so we can get into that stuff before everybody's dead. That would be nice.
Well, that's like in the Bush administration. You know, if you go back and read Watergate stuff and the transition out of Watergate to Ford and all that, the names that keep coming up are Rumsfeld and Cheney. And it's like you were living a movie sequel and you didn't even know. Nobody asked for that sequel necessarily, but we got it. It's just that they weren't the headline names. In a lot of this stuff, the names recur cyclically over time. And it's because we don't necessarily pay enough attention that people reemerge kind of like shingles.
To bring it back to baseball on that topic, though,
thank you.
This is an amazing thing that, not doing it for the purposes of the show, you literally legitimately knocked something in my head, though. I was on a podcast with Mike Bates and Bill Parker recently. They do a historical podcast. And I was on it. We were talking about collusion. So I was going back and rereading all the stuff on collusion. And what people in the game now or younger fans don't realize is, we're 30 years out from collusion. Not the effects, but from the actual events. And the names there are still a lot of names. Bud Selig and Jerry Reinsdorf, but Sandy Alderson. And a lot of people who are still around the game, people who have been inducted into the Hall of Fame, they've been whitewashed from history too. But people think of collusion as something that happened so long ago, and it did. But the people involved were very, very important in the game until very recently, and some still are. And when you see just how long of a tail everything in history has, you realize how hard it is to escape from history, because there are still people who are working on shaping their legacy, who are either trying to bury the past or reframe the past. And that magical day that everybody looks forward to with optimism of, well, we're going to move beyond this and we'll be better, I don't know that it ever happens, because things linger so long. And then when you add on the fact that the people who were involved in bad stuff mentored people who are now in power, no one ever will let that die. And so the idea that we're just going to turn the page on the JFK assassination or collusion in baseball or Watergate or anything in any clean sort of fashion, I think, is a fantasy.
Well, that's a really good point. And of course, history that you didn't live through tends to compress itself. And as you were saying that, I was thinking that Branch Rickey went from being a player to a manager and an executive, I guess, in the late teens, and was still a consultant for the Cardinals and a pretty active one at the time that he died in the early 60s. So you're talking about a 50-year arc. Similarly, George Weiss, who is one of the guys who helped perpetuate the apartheid baseball system that Branch Rickey helped to tear down, first came up to the majors as an executive, with the Yankees when they started their farm system around 1932, and rose to be the general manager of the Yankees in 1947, and then was the general manager of the expansion Mets until he stepped down, and that would have been somewhere around 1965. So it's over 30 years. And every day of those 30 years, or the 50 years of Branch Rickey, played out just like our days, 1 hour at a time. But it's all in the rearview mirror for us, so I can go to a shelf, or you can, and all of those days and years are compressed down into the pages of a 500-page book. But in real terms, one of the reasons that you can't just say the pre-integration era ended the day Jackie Robinson came up is not just because teams like the Red Sox were slow to embrace it, and it wasn't just the Red Sox, it was many teams, but that the people involved in it perpetuated themselves in the game for decades. And so it doesn't really go away until there's been maybe not 100% turnover, but a massive more turnover than certainly we've had since the days of collusion.
Yep. Yeah. Nothing ever dies. And, it's a friend of mine has a father who, nice old guy, who is one of those people that sits on his front porch and sort of optimisms and all that kind of stuff. History has a long tail, he says, as he takes a drink of something. And I think of that all the time. Whenever we talk about something, whether it's recent history or old history, it's never really dead. The way we learn about it in school makes it seem like it's contained in a very short, distinct time period. And as you said, it becomes compressed even if we study it at greater length. When I start railing about collusion, or I start railing about the owner's labor tactics in the 1990s or whatever, there's a huge number of people on Twitter or wherever it is I'm ranting that tell me to shut up, stop living in the past, it's a different time now. It's like, well, yeah, it is, and you got to acknowledge what has changed, but you can't forget what happened. because it definitely informs what's going on now.
I thought you were going to go in a different direction with that old guy sitting on the porch, because I think we've also had the experience, many of us, of encountering the old guy sitting on the porch, that wonderful, magical old guy with the twinkle in his eye and the folksy wisdom, who will then spit out something just very casually, frighteningly racist.
Oh, yeah.
And you realize he's less of an anachronism than you think, because depending on the year, you start working backwards. Well, that guy is 75 years old, which means that his parents were born in 1900, which means that their parents were around during the Civil War. And suddenly, we're back with Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis, and we haven't gone too far. And that means that the germ of that thought, that bad thought, has transmitted itself down to the present day. And despite all the changes, like you said, as long as those people are perpetuating themselves, as long as they still exist, as long as there's a direct line to the past, it's still alive. It doesn't go away that easily.
I find it amazing that Americans can look at some conflict in a faraway land and sort of wave their hand at it and say, hey, that's been going on for 1,000 years. There's no solving that. You know, whether it's the Middle East or whether it's, you know, Central Asia or wherever it is, people will say, well, there's bad blood there going back generations and generations and centuries. And then turn to U.S. events and say, hey, the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, so it's all over. Why are we still talking about this? And the idea that we can say that something here has changed and that what was going on in the 1960s or going on in the 1980s or whatever is now no longer relevant is just ridiculous to me, for that reason that you mentioned, right? This stuff gets passed along. And one of the more interesting things about, you know, my family, for example, my parents are both from the Detroit area, and my dad, he was in Dearborn, Michigan. My dad is 73 years old. So he's not quite a baby boomer, but he's, you know, mostly a baby boomer for all practical purposes as far as how he grew up and everything. And it wasn't that long ago that he retired and stuff. But he grew up in Dearborn, Michigan. And Dearborn, Michigan was an incredibly segregated city, really, until the early 1970s. It's now famous for being one of the largest Muslim cities outside of the Arab world. It's a huge, diverse, crazy, wonderful town near Detroit now. But until the 1970s, it was controlled by this mayor named Orville Hubbard, who was basically George Wallace, but he just happened to live up north. And he was under, like, DOJ investigation. He ran the city of Dearborn from Canada once to avoid subpoenas. I mean, crazy. But my dad was friends with his daughter, grew up in Dearborn. He'd tell me these stories about how Dearborn operated. If a black family was going to move in, you know, it was right across the line from the city of Detroit. It was close in to work and places, but it was still a nicer, lower crime area and everything. So family might want to move in. They would send, Hubbard would send the police there, and he'd set up lines. And when they say, what are you doing here? Oh, we're just waiting for the crowd to show up. They would do everything they can to keep the city segregated. This was happening in my lifetime. And it hugely informed my dad and the way he grew up and his racial attitudes and his family's racial attitudes and everything. Then you talk to someone just about historical events and political events, and you talk about segregation and stuff, it's as if it were ancient history. It's not. It's not at all. Everyone who is an adult now is a generation at most removed from people who were deeply embedded in that and certainly formed by it. And their parents were formed by it and everything. So nothing dies. Nothing dies. The best hope that we have is that it erodes, not that it just dies, because people don't operate that way. You don't shake deeply held beliefs that were ingrained in you, especially if they came from your parents and you respected your parents' word or feared them or whatever. You just don't shake that stuff overnight. You might learn how to be more publicly acceptable. You might learn how to avoid the tells. But the attitude, the underlying attitudes, are always there, hopefully diminishing over time. That's the best we could hope for.
And just to emphasize what you were talking about in terms of the cognitive processes at work, you talked about how people said, well, we had the Civil Rights Act in 1964, so isn't all that over? If you read Rick Perlstein's Nixonland, which is about the origins of the modern Republican Party, he points out that the backlash that changed the electorate, because in 1964, Lyndon Johnson won the biggest landslide ever, one of the biggest landslides ever for the Republican Party. For the Democratic Party. And then by 1972, that had completely reversed itself and Nixon had an even bigger win. And so there was a dramatic realignment that took place. And one key thing that he points to is that the Civil Rights Act passed in July 64, and just 13 months later, the first Watts riots erupted in Los Angeles. And this became kind of a national thing, these riots in the inner cities. And people then, just a year later, were saying, wait, we had the Civil Rights Act. All that's over now. They should be happy.
Right.
So it's like we need a much longer view than we have. Never mind taking the 50-year view. Like, we need to get people off the idea that what happened 6 months ago is ancient history.
And I don't know how you do that necessarily. It's not necessarily a toxic thing. It's not like people want to pretend everything's fixed while they can secretly be evil still. I mean, it's just the way people are naturally attuned, especially for things that they don't deal with themselves on a day-to-day basis. If you're a white middle-class family in a suburb somewhere, you're not dealing with issues of racial justice on a day-to-day basis. It just doesn't affect you. You're not going to have your attitudes changed. You're just going to assume that, okay, that's over. We did that. I'm guilty of that on other issues. We all are. You see a natural disaster happen somewhere and it gets huge news for a few days and you're terribly invested in it. And then all of a sudden, if it wasn't where I am, you start to forget about it. I think that's human nature. I think we have such a large country and a large world that it's very hard for any one person to stay on top of these things. And so we just file it away and think, okay, well, that's now sorted. And it's not.
I want to ask you something else about last night's game. If I can take the liberty of paraphrasing, I feel like you wrote something recently that said that anyone who complains that there are too many home runs right now is a grumpy old sourpuss. And I would like to raise my hand and say that I am a grumpy old sourpuss. And I felt that way, especially last night when the big blow in the game, the thing that began the Yankees breaking it open, was Todd Frazier taking an off-balance, one-handed swing, basically, and hitting a pop-up down the right field line that went over the short porch in Yankee Stadium. I didn't think there was the slightest chance of that going out. Grant Brisby had a great tweet saying that wouldn't have gone out in San Francisco either because it would have been just over Joe Panik's glove. And I really do feel like the amount, the frequency, the way that the ball is jumping has diminished the home run a little bit. And so many of these postseason games seem to be revolving around the ball being hit out of the park. I'm not saying that you're wrong, and I'm not totally dismissing the joy of the long ball, but I do have a difference of opinion with you on that.
I sort of put it that way, the whole you're a grumpy sourpuss if you don't like the homers thing, intentionally, provocatively. I have sort of a two-track thought process about this sort of stuff. I think on a very basic human level, of course you can not like the number of home runs. I've said loud and clear how the number of strikeouts and the high-velocity pitchers is just not for me. It's just not something I'm a big fan of. I don't think it's as good of baseball or an enjoyable baseball product for me as a different sort of baseball. And I think it's completely legitimate to say, I think there are too many home runs, or I think there are too many cheap home runs. It's not what I prefer. What I'm trying to guard against with those don't be a grumpy old sourpuss comments are then taking the next step of I don't prefer it, and no one else can prefer it, and there is an ideal of baseball that I like better that is clearly superior, objectively speaking, because that's normally the second step people take. You heard this so much in the 90s and early 2000s when people would talk about the 60s and the idea that there was once a really good baseball and now it's just a bad baseball. And if you like the current baseball, you're wrong and bad. And if you don't like what I liked, you're wrong and bad. That's the step I'm trying to guard against. You know, personally, do I think the home runs are great? Some of them are cheap. I mean, I thought Frazier's home run was pretty cheap. I think you can take that too far. Someone looked at it this morning. I don't know who it was, but apparently there were something like 32 home runs hit in Minute Maid Park that didn't go as far as Frazier's did last night. So maybe Astros fans that were talking about how cheap that was should kind of be quiet about it. Because, you know, Minute Maid is not exactly the Polo Grounds dead center field or anything. So, you know, my view is there's a difference between having a preference about a style of baseball or whatever's going on in baseball in the day and whether you enjoy it or not. I can perfectly enjoy cheap Todd Frazier home runs because I look at any given baseball game as a distinct piece of entertainment. And in the context of that game, where it stood in the series, I laughed out loud when he hit the homer, not just because it was cheap, but just because, wow, that's interesting, and that certainly has changed things. And I can enjoy it while I can still say, maybe it's not for me. And I think there are too many people that look at something that isn't for them or it's not to their taste and then just refuse to enjoy it and refuse to believe anyone can enjoy it. That's the thing that bugs me.
Well, I'll give you another geek culture analogy for that I think you'll appreciate. The character of Batman has existed since 1939. And in that time, he's been done many, many different ways. You can have the Dark Avenger of the night, and he can be portrayed as a fairly well-balanced Dark Avenger of the night for a guy who dresses up in leather and beats people up. And then other people do him as an extreme psychopath who's just humorless and grim and has no joy in him whatsoever. You can have the Adam West version, which is played for comedy. In the 1950s, as often as not in the comic books, he ended up on Mars, which seems like the really wrong context for the concept. The point is, there's no official right way to do it. It's just whatever you can convincingly do as a writer and an artist with the character. And baseball is the same way. Like, you may prefer the Adam West Batman, or I might like the Kevin Conroy Mark Hamill cartoon better than the Brave and the Bold cartoon with Dietrich Bader from a few years ago. But nobody's right. And so, I mean, maybe there's somebody out there who wants to see the dead ball era come back and just have bunting and hit and runs all the time and have no home runs whatsoever. I don't think there are too many people like that. I always advocate for the baseball I grew up with, A, because that's natural. That's a natural prejudice that people have. But it was also a very balanced game in the 80s with a lot of speed and a lot of power and some batting average. And I miss that game. But I don't think this game is wrong. I just feel like it's just slightly 5% out of balance, something like that.
I think that's totally fair, and I think that's the best way to put it. I didn't really think about that in baseball terms. I you know, everyone, this is a good week for people not liking Twitter. Well, it's always a good week for people not liking Twitter. You know, Joe Madden was complaining about Twitter the other day. Twitter does have some good points, and the one thing that Twitter has done for me in the pushing 10 years I've been on it is expose me to people I wouldn't normally talk to.
Right.
And, you know, I'm 44. I don't have a lot of friends who are 26. But on Twitter, I talk to a lot of people who are 26. And you talk to people who grew up, whose first baseball memory was, you know, 1998. When that happens and you listen to them and you hear how the, you know, my first thought is, how could anyone, I mean, I enjoyed baseball then, but how could anyone think that that's the best baseball? But, you know, it was for some people.
Right.
You give them a hearing, and they're not going to convince me any more than I'm going to convince them that, you know, Jack Morris was the best money pitcher of all time or something. You know, why would they? I wouldn't listen to me on that. But, you know, the idea that it's very possible to enjoy grim and gritty Batman and campy Batman is the same thing. It's a perfect analogy, I think.
Thank you.
And yes, it's great. I hadn't even thought about it that way, but that's true. Baseball is malleable. Baseball has had so many different eras. And the trap that people fall into is thinking that the era they grew up with was the definitive era or the only era. And I think that was on steroids with the people who came of age in the 50s and early 60s, that golden age of baseball stuff that thankfully is, I think, starting to die a little bit as the people who advocated have started to die. Well, I mean, it came on TV and it, you know, just it became a very different thing. There's a lot more footage available and everything. So there are a lot of non-old fogey reasons why golden age baseball became golden age baseball. It's funny, I'm starting to see now people your age and my age who grew up with 80s baseball of balanced schedule and great parity and a lot of speed and stuff like that. We are becoming those golden age people. We're not exactly speaking in sepia tones, but we might as well be in some ways. I don't search my name on Twitter or something, but once in a while I'll come across a subtweet after I've been going on about, you know, Alan Trammell or something, and you know, someone will be like, oh, there goes old man Calcaterra again. And I'm like, yeah, there he does go. You're right. That's absolutely right. And it's worth checking yourself. I mean, don't be Steve Buscemi and put the hat on backwards and say, how do you do, fellow kids, and pretend that you're something you're not. That's a bad look too, but maybe acknowledge that we don't have a monopoly on wisdom or taste, and God knows, given when we grew up, we don't have a monopoly on good taste.
I think that the one time I might have grown up as a baseball fan and be put off of baseball are, say, the late 40s and early 50s, that period you're talking about. Because by the time we were kids, there was one guy walking 120 batters a year, and that was Nolan Ryan. In the 40s and 50s, everybody was walking 150 guys a year because they were so home run averse that they would rather pitch around the entire lineup somehow than actually let somebody put the ball in play. And it must have been agonizing. I once asked Charlie Silvera what it was like to play with Tommy Byrne, who is a guy with the Yankees who was just a three true outcomes pitcher. And he said guys were dying because the ball would never leave home plate. It was just a strikeout or a walk. And you're sitting there in flannels in 95 degree heat wanting to kill yourself. And I can only imagine what that was like as a spectator. Like, you could go to the beer line and never miss a thing. But
I wish we had more diaries, or I wish we had more real-time accounts of baseball fans then, because I can talk to my grandfather before he died and ask him what the Depression was like, and he'll talk about, it was pretty good. It was fine, you know, he fought in World War II. God, that must have been incredible when you liberated the concentration camp. Yeah, it was kind of a bad scene, but, you know, we had good days then. You know, it's the human memory is always, just as a matter of, I think, natural selection and everything else, it pushes the darkness away for most people. And you remember the good things and you cast out the bad things. And I think that's a huge portion of baseball fans from the 50s and stuff. Who only seem to remember Mickey Mantle winning the Triple Crown, or only seem to remember all those great highlights, but don't remember any of the crap. I had this conversation about Bo Jackson just like 2 days ago on Twitter. We were talking about Gen X heroes, and I made the joke. I said, Gen X has no heroes. And then people started to talk about sports heroes. And I said, you know, Bo Jackson is a guy who, I was a kid when he came out of Auburn, and I was a young kid and a young man when he started, and he was amazing to watch. And I, you know, objectively speaking, he was an amazing specimen. When he was on as a football player, he was unstoppable. When he was on his game as a baseball player, he was definitely fun. But something has happened with the legend of Bo Jackson, and it is definitely a legend now, where if you talk to anyone around our age, or a lot of people even older, they'll talk about Bo Jackson as if he was, you know, the second coming of Christ, just in baseball. And I'm like, you know, Bo Jackson had a couple of nice seasons, and he had a couple of nice highlights, but Bo Jackson was kind of a flawed player in some ways too, and I don't know if he had committed himself to baseball. I think he'd be an on and off all-star and a very good player, but probably not a Hall of Fame type. But he's talked about as if he was, you know, put here by the hand of God. And when you ask, when you try to prod that and you explore that idea, you always get the same data points. Remember that home run in the All-Star game. Remember when he ran up the wall, and remember when he broke the bat over his leg. People remember those highlights that get perpetuated over and over again on flashback shows, and people remember those big things. But remember when he struck out four times against the Mariners? Well, no one remembers that. So that's just how it works, and it's easier to do it, especially with someone who's not around anymore. And Bo Jackson, from a baseball perspective, ceased to be around once his career ended. It was premature. That's why Sandy Koufax gets talked up the way Sandy Koufax got talked up. He didn't have a final 6 or 7 years of his career of decline. We're able to fill in the blanks with things like that, and the farther back they go, we fill in the blanks even more, to the point where things become idealized. And you see it with Bo Jackson, you see it with 1950s baseball, we're starting to do it with 1980s baseball. 1970s baseball is a good one too, because now everyone wants to talk about how funky the 1970s were. I love Dan Epstein, I think his books are amazing, but his Big Hair Plastic Grass book, which I think is fantastic, has done so much to make people think that baseball in the 70s was nothing but awesome, because look at those guys. And there's an element to that, but you know, I think we sort of lose some of the baseball and focus more on the Oscar Gamble card. It's just, again, how memory works, how people work.
There was a game that the Royals played at Yankee Stadium somewhere about, I don't know, 1990. I'm not going to look this up, so this is from flawed memory. But in his first two at-bats, Bo Jackson homered. It may even have been his first three at-bats. Let's just go with the exaggeration of memory and say he homered his first three times up. Deion Sanders was also in that game. Deion Sanders hit a line drive for the Yankees to center field. Jackson dove for it, missed it. Sanders circled the bases about as fast as I've ever seen anyone run the bases for an inside the park home run. And if you just remembered that game in isolation, you would think that these were the two greatest ball players that you'd ever seen. And of course they weren't. They were dilettantes. They were guys who were part-timing it. And the real aftermath of that game was that Sanders was helicoptered off to the Atlanta Falcons camp and didn't play for the rest of the year. And Jackson injured himself diving for the ball and didn't play again for the rest of the year. Something like that. So it depends where you cut your memories off. And you can, like you said, remember the highlights, but you're leaving off all of the negatives. And again, that's what happens to memory. We round off the rough edges.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that doesn't mean the highlights didn't happen. I don't want to piss all over the people that think Bo Jackson was the most exciting thing they ever saw, because, God, he was exciting. It was amazing. So those moments, they happened. I mean, they did happen, and they were great. We build them into something bigger than they were, and it's a difficult balance, especially with a topic like baseball that is so based in anecdote and so based in memory and so based in emotion. And the stakes aren't as high, right? If you get a historical fact wrong, that could have a major impact if you're a policymaker. If you get a baseball fact wrong, well, that just adds to the stories. That's why there's so much BS. That's why our friend Rob Nyer can write an entire book about baseball legends that didn't really happen. It's a great part of the game, but it can be frustrating for someone who comes at it slightly more left-brained, like I do, compared to a lot of other fans. I'll probably, till the day I die, argue with people about how good Bo Jackson was, and it's only going to get worse over time.
Well, Craig, the grounds crew has shown up my development, which means that the leaf blowers will soon be making their presence felt on this podcast, which is a hazard of podcasting, I suppose, one among many, including cats, dogs, and cows intruding on your show, technical difficulties, and people blowing non-existent leaves off of your property. But before we wrap up, you brought up Joe Maddon, and this was a hot topic this week, so I do feel like asking, and I'll beg the question in the way that I state things, but how the heck can a manager, and it doesn't have to be Joe Maddon, how can any manager in this day and age save his closer in a tie game on the road for a lead that he may never get? Aren't we past this very basic, the earth might be flat kind of thinking?
I would like to think we are, and I've been very hard on Joe Maddon over that decision not to use Wade Davis the last couple of days, and I'm not going to come off of that position. 2 days later, I will now give a slight, maybe he just knows that Wade Davis had nothing, and he didn't want to make it seem like Wade Davis was soft. Not that he came up to Maddon and said, I can't pitch today or something, but just maybe there was enough there where I would rather take the heat for a wrong decision and let Wade Davis become the story of why can't you pitch after a day off or something. That's being probably overly charitable. I think what probably happened was Maddon thinking, I'll bet you I can get away with this. And I think that temptation, he knows better. He knows what happened to Buck Showalter last year. He knows what happened when Freddie Gonzalez left Craig Kimbrell in the bullpen against the Dodgers in the NLDS a few years ago. He's not a dumb man, and he has a good memory. I think he also has a healthy ego, as anyone who's had the success he has should have, by the way. And he's thinking, you know what? I'm going to get John Lackey here. He can get three outs or two outs or whatever he needed, and I'm going to look great, and Lackey's going to look like he's having glory in maybe the last inning he ever pitches, and I'm just going to hope this works. For as objective as managers are, for as objective as we want baseball people to be in this day and age, I think there's a part of every guy in there who thinks, I'm going to wing this, and I think I can make it work because I just feel like it might. And Maddon is susceptible just like anyone else's.
You know, for a generation of politicians, Munich was their great lesson in terms of how to conduct foreign policy. Then it was 9/11, skipping forward in time. Vietnam was certainly a thing that changed the way politicians and statesmen went about things. And I feel like in the same way that every manager should know that game four of the 2003 World Series, Joe Torre lost a game with Mariano Rivera in the bullpen and Jeff Weaver on the mound. It should be like an instructional film, an indoctrinational film that's shown to everybody. And if not that, then certainly Zach Britton last year. I hope you're right. I hope that it will come out later that Wade Davis had pulled something or had some bad shrimp. Anything really that would rationalize that decision in retrospect. We never do learn not to have markdown shrimp either. Craig, thank you very much for coming by. It's great to catch up with you again, and I look forward to the next time. Ray Shields, we've come to the end of another episode. You can follow Craig Calcaterra on Twitter at Craig Calcaterra. No guessing at all. It's just right there, all in his name. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Golgotha Stephen Goldman was misleadingly biblical. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com. We have a sponsor now whose ads mysteriously do not always appear due to reasons beyond my control, but we nonetheless are brought to you by the number 25. Our producer is at this point anybody who will walk in off the street and relieve me of my weary burdens, please. I beg you, please, I can't take this anymore. Our theme song, which you are listening to now and have been listening to throughout the episode, was co-authored by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. You should see what he used to order on summer nights at Denny's. Well, if the ghosts of the damned don't find my new secret location in Beltsville, Maryland, oops. Well, if they weren't listening, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.